period that they can accommodate. Okay, there's a lot of conditions going on, and sometimes we get requests from our labs to do work like this, and we can't take it on. Something is out of whack. The skill was wrong. we don't have to hire the guy instead of having, or the timing was wrong. Something was out of whack. But by and large, the contractors are receptive to this kind of activity. Now, to answer your question, the inspection process was one of those task assignments.
The regular inspection, yeah, every 30 days or so, what you said earlier.
No, the special inspections.
Oh, the special
regular
inspections.
Ones are programmed into our contract. That's
they are
as
also
part of
covered,
the workload after it comes out of storage. One thing you got to do is inspect, okay? But the process of one more time, fellas, look again at this list that you identified as critical components, non-critical components, and one more time, what is the inspection frequency you recommend? That kind of effort, which is really desk effort. He doesn't physically go out and look at the thing, but he gets his quality people, he gets his records, gets his manufacturing techniques, and he lays it out, gets a group of people, and one more time goes through it. And out of this, something usually falls out. You find something, and every time you go through it, you do it a little better. That kind of effort is task assignment.
Okay, fine. That really answers my question. I think we have talked enough about stress corrosion, or do we have some other questions here?
It's not clear to me at one point is when, I'm talking about the total, not the total vehicle, but the total stage, SMC stage, for instance, at what point in time was a program initiated to review the total stage for stress corrosion? Was this as a result of the actuator problem, or was there a program initiated prior to that time, or how did this come about?
You're asking, I think from a calendar point of view, and I just can't remember. It was not the actuator problem. We did not go into a first-class stress corrosion major study as a result of that. When we finished our job on the actuator and made all these decisions to go get new procurement, we all wiped the sweat off our brow and figured, well, that's that. Thank goodness. We did not follow it up with a major stress corrosion inspection process at that time. And I'm trying to remember when we did. And I frankly just can't pin that down.
On the other hand, I'm sure the labs really dug into it and they looked for similar events that could have happened, and probably the contractor did the same. Maybe our people even talked to the contractor.
But we didn't have a major program or sponsored thrust.
It was not in the management, clearly,
in the case of Pogo, we had the launch there, it was, and boy, everybody took off. Stress corrosion, that kind of problem built up, and we had to have a number of instances. We had to get hit over the head a couple times before we took off on that one. Because it's the kind of thing that you always hope will go away. And whenever it shows up in a different spot that seems to be unique with the previous spot. And we had to have a number of knocks over the head to get ourselves thinking in the way of a program-sponsored thrust at that problem.
And what really brought it to light, of course, was the delay in the last Skylab launch. Then people
It was before that, Connie.
The effort was going on before.
The major effort in the stress corrosion studies, investigations, and the things I lined out was before this 1B-fin problem. For instance, we had S1CF, the facilities bird. That had gone to the Cape and been exposed to the salt atmosphere of the Cape for over a year. It had been sitting outside here in our backyard over there, for many years as kind of a museum piece. One of the things we did in the stress corrosion area was send that thing down to Michoud, completely disassemble it to look for parts that we couldn't normally see. It was a shell essentially, but a structure that we were worried about, and not the electrical stuff and the black boxes. They weren't in there anyway. But we tore down S1CF, thoroughly inspected it, and out of that process, we found other parts that we want to keep a tab on, put on the list, okay? Then reassembled it as a museum piece, cleaned it up, and it's a real pretty looking thing, but it's just a museum piece today.
Mm-hmm.
All of that happened long before the 1B fin, okay? But I just can't pin time.
And it probably was something that grew, yeah?
Yeah.
You added a little bit here, a little bit there. You had a longer list of items you had to inspect.
Yeah.
Okay, so did that answer your question, Dick?
Thank you.
I have now the question that we haven't been able to settle at all. When Lee James was working on this contract, he put an item down which I don't even quite understand, and maybe you can shed some light on it. He put down S1C bellows vibration, and I even have dug up a date, 26 June 69, where this thing must have happened. But I haven't been able to find anything in the literature, anything in a report or so. Of course, I have not gone through the whole set on five files, yeah? So maybe you have an idea in mind, at least, what it could be.
Did he say S1C?
It said S1C, it's even written up.
Okay. And this was in...
We had a bellows problem on the S2, yeah?
Yeah, but he wasn't talking that. Okay. The
bellows... Unless he mixed it up. He may have mixed up his numbers. That's a possibility, yeah?
Okay.
And my question to you is really, did we have an S1C bellows problem? As I said, I'm not aware of one, and I have not been able to find anything in the literature.
Yeah, we did.
Could you summarize briefly the technical problem and again what we did?
The problem was in our pressure volume compensators, which are at the base of the LOX lines and before you go into the engines.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We have a what they call a PVC duct.
Mm-hmm.
And what this is supposed to do is compensate for the variations of pressure and volume. So that the engine sees an essential constant flow mass into it on the LOX side. I think we also had them on the fuel side, they're smaller, but they were not the problem. It was the LOX ones, which were the big ones, 22 inches in diameter. And this PVC duct is designed with bellows. It's double walled. And the outside looks just like a tube, but inside there's two double walls of bellows. And those bellows were cracking. The inner wall was cracking.
It also stress corrosion?
No, it was not stress corrosion. It was a pure, flat-out fatigue crack.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Coupled or aggravated with poor welding in certain cases that brought it to light, but was basically a design deficiency related to fatigue, life cycles. And as I recall it, the particular feature of that bellows was redesigned and new bellows were installed. This was found during static firing, accelerated or through our static firing program, not during launch. And we kind of treated it as a manufacturing problem to be corrected and modified.
So it was a routine change order, yeah?
It was a routine change order. Quite an expensive one because we had to go into retrofit programs.
Did we have to pay extra for that or was it again covered by the scope of work?
I think we had to pay for that one.
Yeah?
I think we had to pay for that one.
Mm-hmm.
There was a special fixture, I remember, that we had to design in order to remove a pressure volume compensator in an assembled stage, which is quite a trick to do. Apparently this thing is somehow aligned or compressed in a manner that getting it out is a hell of a lot easier than putting it in without removing engines and all and working up, you know. So we had to design that thing, a holding fixture, go in vertically, grab a hold of this thing, compress it, and move it out and down. And do that five times on each stage that had the bad one in.
Do you think there's anything in writing on this subject?
Yeah, I think there is, Connie. There must be. And it's probably in our S1C files way on back there somewhere, at least in one of our pre-launch reviews.
That's another question I have.
Digging it out.
Particularly in your new capacity as Saturn office. You know, Matt is now the deputy of the whole Saturn office here, yeah? Do you have somewhere a central file?
Yeah.
Place where all these things are being kept.
We had to make one. As a matter of fact, we got it down in the basement of this building. We got three rooms down there, nothing but file cabinets. Okay, all this old historical.
So data. They are available, yeah.
Yeah.
And it would be probably just a matter of extensive digging.
It would
digging,
take some time for somebody who knows what he's looking for to go down there and start searching.
I might want to do that.
Pretty
one of these days.
I'm sure you'll find all sorts of funny things in the files, because these guys, they're pack rats. They didn't want to...
Well, I know we started that under Oswald Lange.
Three rooms this size here, full of file cabinets.
Under Lange, we were supposed to keep one copy of every important document in a file, yeah?
Yeah.
And Chris Holloway was the one who started that whole thing, yeah? And I'm glad to hear that it really was apparently continued, yeah?
Yeah.
I never had talked to anyone, so I didn't know if that thing was still there.
The thing is sectioned out, though, so that each project office has their own historical file area.
That's probably the logical thing to do.
There's not one person like a librarian.
Is there something like systems engineering?
Systems engineering? Yeah, they got a whole bunch of files down there.
The systems engineering office, yeah?
The systems engineering office.
Mm-hmm.
That's now Jewel Moody. We combined him with the reliability and quality.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got, he inherited all the old systems engineering files.
Yeah.
And he's got quite a bit of space down there for that. So it is available, Connie, but it takes some searching.
Okay, and we might have to do that one of these days, yeah? But for the time being, I think Matt gave us a pretty good description on this bellows thing, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
At least it's something to think about, and we have not decided yet if we really want to put that in our study, yeah?
There was another bellows problem, and this was the S2, you know, where we broke the bellows in the flank.
Yeah.
And that was entirely different. That
was
this old story of 2-ply versus 3-ply bellows. We all went back to 2-ply to solve that problem. But that's another story.
I even have a little bit information on that, yeah? So I have a pretty fair story on that. You mentioned Pogo earlier, and I have talked to Emil Hellebrand quite a bit about Pogo, to Erich Görner. In fact, he had even some write-ups on that thing. So technically, I have some pretty good information on that subject. What I haven't been able to find out is who set up the Pogo team. Was it something that Sam Phillips started, or did Rees start it?
No.
And my personal impression is that Rees started
it. No, Dr. Rees started it.
That's also your impression. That's my impression from all I've heard,
Pogo is a particular problem associated with propulsion vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
Marshall Space Flight Center was responsible.
Yeah.
It was quite proper that that Rees set it up, took the lead on it in setting it up.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
I even think he kind of chaired all the early meetings. Yeah,
he
was the one who called the meetings together, and who then probably in the meeting appointed. And I think it was first Hellebrand. And then Görner took over pretty soon after that.
Yeah, and then another guy took over after Görner.
And then after that, Sterrett.
Sterrett
was
Jim
the one who is still on it right now.
And Jim still carries it.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that's really all I have on questions at this time concerning Pogo, Dick, because I don't think we have to go into all the technical details, yeah? Now, let me ask you another more general question, Matt. What is, in your opinion, the biggest S1C problem? What did you think you had to wrestle most with in order to really overcome it? And I asked this question for that purpose. I have almost the impression we had more problems on all other stages. S2, I'm sure you are fully aware of the many, many problems we had on the S2, yeah? Even the S4B had quite a number of explosions and little mishaps.
In the way of a technical problem, it was purely S1C?
Well, technical or management problem. But strictly S1C,
Strictly S1C.
What did you look at as the biggest?
I would have to say it was the vent valves, the LOX vent valves.
The LOX vent valves?
Yeah.
I hadn't even thought of those at all.
That was the biggest one.
What was the problem there?
From a management point of view and from a technical point of view. The LOX vent valves that actually, we had designed them and directed the procurement of them to Boeing. Trying to think of the vendor. I think it's Arrowhead. No? Arrowhead? Well, no matter. The feature of the vent valve, it's a visor closing valve. Right? Mm-hmm. It's like a semi-hemisphere. It opens in a along one axis, rotates out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
And when it closes, it has a double movement. It closes, right, and then moves forward onto a seal. Okay? So you don't get sliding motion across the seal. And then when it opens, it moves back away from the seal and then rotates out of the way. Right? And this was this is hydraulically actuated, okay, through a rack and pinion. Piston with a rack on it, okay, drives forward and it turns a gear and rotates the visor. Okay. Now, the fact that this thing is so big, so complicated in its mechanism of moving, and the fact that it had to operate at cryogenic temperatures, okay, every once in a while we'd get a valve to stick. There'd be a hesitation. It wouldn't be that it didn't open or didn't close, but there'd be a hesitation. There'd be say on the slow side of the spec in its opening and closing rate. Okay? And we would, when we first saw this, we thought, well, this is just peculiarities of one valve to the next, say, and maybe our mm-hmm. specs are too tight. And then we started getting repeats. Okay? That is, a valve that closed or opened in a slow history during static firing, the next time we saw that valve, serial numbered valve, would be a little slower than it was before, say, and a little slower later. And finally we got one that wouldn't open up at all, say, it just flat out stuck. Say. And that happened on a launch, I forget which one. Apollo 13. No, Apollo 12. The one where we had to abort the mission and come back.
That was 13.
Yeah. On that one, during the launch countdown, there are two LOX vent valves up there, and one froze. Say, and froze closed. So we locked it closed, and we operated with the other one,
mm-hmm.
which was perfectly safe mode to do. Because when you lift off, all valves are closed anyway. You pressurize mm-hmm. your tank, say, and the normal mode for those valves to be in is enclosed.
Mm-hmm.
You vent only on the ground to relieve pressure, say, and you vent only in the air in case of emergency, say. However, you have an override on that emergency. Either of those two valves can vent the pressure. Then there's a mechanical direct override on those things. It'll force them open.
Could you still have done that with the one that was frozen? Could you still have forced it open?
I don't know. But the one that was operating, we could have.
Mm-hmm.
A double operating mode on that. So, we were so redundant on the valves that we were safe to launch, yet we did launch mm-hmm. with one that was frozen closed to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that then launched us into a very deep effort to find out what was wrong with those valves. And it turned out, after many months of major effort on the part of the contractor, and here, we sent valves here to be tested here at the arsenal.
Mm-hmm. When you say contractor, was it the valve manufacturer or was it Boeing?
It was Boeing and the valve manufacturer.
They both worked on it.
They both worked on
mm-hmm.
it. It turned out to be a tolerance problem. That is, if we opened up certain tolerances, and these are very tight tolerances we were dealing with on these shafts and rotating mechanisms, we found that we could make this problem go away. However, in order to take old valves with tight tolerances, say, bring them back and do these things to them, that was a major effort, and that was a change order.
Mm-hmm.
Say, that was a change order. But it was a no-fee change order. The guy got, Boeing got cost.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't get a penny fee. Right. because he recognized that even though he wasn't directly responsible, i.e. we gave him the design to begin with, right? And so many years of operating with this thing, that he had at least an implied responsibility to the thing, right? So, yeah, he got cost, he didn't get free.
And that was it even a bigger problem than Pogo?
That was not bigger than Pogo, no, but it was an S1C peculiar problem that was very difficult to run down, to identify the problem. You just can't take one valve and say you got the problem with it. You got to look at it with its valve history to recognize that it's getting worse from each test to each test. That takes a long time.
Yeah.
And then we were rather free in reallocating these valves around the place too. They'd be static fired on one stage and then it'd end up flying on another. Okay. So it was very, very difficult to even identify that you had a generic problem as opposed to an isolated singular serial number problem. And the effort of tracing down that thing was most difficult. Once, of course, we found it, the effort of identifying what type of design improvements we can make, that was most difficult too.
And again, you had to go through a lot of testing and you had to verify that your changes were really taking care of the problem.
Yeah, and after all, the problem is one that you can't really say you took care of it until you've had many, many, many tests. Let the valve cycle many, many times.
Yeah, I wasn't even aware of that one, so that's a new interesting thing, and maybe we even want to include that kind of thing in our study.
And I might also add that there was a little bit of a management flavor to that one, in that Boeing had, I guess, was the last one to really recognize it as a technical problem. They, even after looking at all the history of the thing, still was reluctant to accept it as a technical problem. Whereas our labs were quick to realize this, relative to Boeing at least, and we were more or less pushing the contractor in this case, which is a little peculiar. Usually it's the other way around. The problem is usually identified by the contractor, because he works with the hardware, he usually sees it first, and he's usually the one who proposes to us design solutions. This was an oddball. It was the other way around in this case. It made it difficult to handle from a management point of view.
Well, how did you overcome that?
Well, like I say, the best thing I could get out of it was a no-fee change. I was working for a no-cost change, and I settled for a no-fee change.
Well, I wonder why they took the position they did. Why didn't they recognize it? Were they convinced from a technical standpoint that they didn't feel it was a problem, or did they, for one reason or another, take that position?
I don't know if I can speak accurately for Boeing on that point. It might be that you could talk to Tom Cornell, though, at Boeing, since he was my counterpart at that time. And he was the strongest opponent for making changes to the valve at that time. So I'd suggest Tom Cornell would be the man to ask that question to. I mean, I could give you an answer, but I think it would only be second best answer.
Okay, Matt, we have talked about these specific items. Now maybe we can come back briefly to this little write-up I gave you last week. I would particularly like to hear your opinion, particularly now in your new position as deputy here for the whole CETAM program. What do you think is one of the reasons that, in my opinion at least, we have been quite successful with the whole Apollo program? So I'm not only referring to CETAM as such, but of course I would, from you, essentially like to get the CETAM part of the answer. And I had even given you some hints and some ideas what I think, what management philosophies also should be credited for coming to a successful program. Would you care to make a few general comments along that line?
Yeah, Connie, we've all thought about this a lot. Apollo has been a tremendously successful program. We all would like to make sure whatever magic formula went into that would be repeatable. unfortunately, Connie, and the more I think about it, the more I think that it's not practically possible to repeat it. Conditions are different. Look, Apollo was a national commitment. It had everybody's backing. Not only moral backing, political backing, it had the money. I don't recall in the beginning days of Apollo on S1C, for instance, ever being in a situation where I didn't get the money that I asked for. That's amazing. We'll never see that again, I don't think. So when you take one of the three basic elements of management, i.e. schedule, money, and manpower, and say, that's no problem. That certainly is one, you have to recognize that as one of the elements that went into the success formula. Another thing that I think is peculiar to Apollo is we were afforded the opportunity to take our traditional conservative approach toward its design. And I said it that way deliberately. In our future programs, we would like very much to take a conservative approach, as you know, but are forced not to do it by either schedules or constraints of dollars. But in Apollo, we were fortunate that we could implement our conservativeness. And when I say conservativeness, I'm thinking of many things. I'm thinking about a very heavy ground test program. That's static firing vehicles. We built a dynamic test vehicle, full-scale dynamic test, and built a tower bigger than the vehicle to put the whole vehicle in and shake it. Okay? We didn't play around with scale models, we used the real thing. We built a facilities vehicle that enabled it to be used in the factory for checkout of the tooling, for routing of the vehicle, to be used at the Cape for testing of their launch facility. See, as a full scale, we didn't settle for any component testing. We went to the big thing. We had so many new components that each one had to have a certified, qualified test before the first launch. Very unusual. Okay. Usually in programs which are condensed, the first launch or the justification for the first launch is qualification of new hardware. Let's face it. Okay. All our parts were qualified on the ground before it was even launched. Mm-hmm. So we weren't dealing then, we didn't have to worry about component failures in the launch. We knew them. Okay. We got them out of the system. We had to worry about system failures, the things you couldn't test for on the ground. And in any way duplicate the launch environment. And what did we get out of it? Typically, a systems problem, POGO. Could never have identified that on the ground. Mm-hmm. Okay? Because it took the whole vehicle flying through its dynamic profile to bring about that condition. Conservatism means those kinds of things to me. In many cases, there was conservatism in our approach to the manufacturing process. Remember, our first marching orders were set up all your facilities to build 12 a year. We never built 12 a year. Most we put out is 3 a year. Okay? But our facilities were capable of doing 12 a year. That meant that if a particular lathe conked out or a particular a special jig had a problem, you had one right next to it, move on to it. Okay? What a comfortable way to be in. I don't think we could afford those kind of approaches today. Mm-hmm. Since my background is S1C, but I don't think it's just out of line to use it. I think the other stages did the same. In the case S1C, We actually built T-Bird here and the first flight unit here at Marshall. Simply because the Michoud plant